are Locked On NBA, your daily NBA podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome into this Monday's edition of Locked On NBA, where we cover all the latest from around the association. I'm Tony East, the host of Locked On Pacers. And we have to open Locked On NBA on a sadder note this week and this day, as NBA legend and Celtics legend, several-time champion and all-star, one of the best to ever do it, Bill Russell, officially passed away on Sunday. With me from Locked On Celtics, John Corrales, the host of the show. John, can you just for a moment talk about the impact that Bill Russell had both on and off the court as one of the premier legends of the NBA?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to find words because there are no words, no combination of words that anybody can put together that does Bill Russell's legacy any kind of justice. On the court, I mean, how much more dominant can you be than 11 championships in 13 seasons and a loss in the finals as one of the other two seasons, you know, and that loss certainly ate at Russell because he was hurt, and it was the St. Louis Hawks beating his Celtics, and Bob Pettit had a huge series, and Russell was injured. He had sprained his ankle, and, you know, he was still a little salty about that. Because if he was healthy, they probably would have won that too. And he'd be talking about 12 out of 13 seasons. And then, you know, capping it off with championships as a player coach and the first black coach, first black head coach in the NBA, his legacy is just, it reaches far and wide because he took stands in the 60s during the civil rights era that not everyone was willing to take, especially a guy like Russell, who was as dominant as he was on the court. You could argue that he stood to lose a lot, but he was front and center with Muhammad Ali, with Lew Alcindor at the time, with Jim Brown, taking on a very difficult era in American history. So he wore his Presidential Medal of Freedom as proudly as he wore any championship ring, maybe more so. And that legacy, like in the face of some of the most virulent, hateful acts that he endured, not just on the road through the South, refusing to play when his black teammates were refused service. Not just that, in Boston, where people broke into his house and, like, just, I mean, horrible, horrible things, you know, vandalized his house. He, in the face of that, through it all, said, the only thing I can do to show you guys that you're wrong and prove to you that you're bigots and how wrong you are is to just keep on winning. And that's what he did. That's how he channeled his rage. And he channeled it on the court as a champion and a leader, and off the court as a civil rights champion and a leader. It's an immense legacy that we could go on for hours about.
It's scarce to, I think too many times this term is turned around, but he is a legend, like as a person. He's a very important person in terms of history, both in terms of on and off court impact, I think, you know. Well, he never lost a game seven. He won a bunch in college. That's all very important in terms of his legacy, the Celtics legacy, things like that. But for him, the person to be really good when he was in the 50s and 60s, when the NBA was in its infancy, he really helped the league take off in relevancy, not just in Boston, but nationally as well. You know, they had a popular, talented team that fans could latch onto. They would travel around, and then in new markets, teams want to watch the Celtics. They want to watch Bill Russell, this guy who can never lose, who's winning the All-Stars every year, who's leading the league in scoring and rebounding, and is the best defensive player. That he was the draw. He was huge for the growth of the NBA. And then going into a post-playing career, that was very important for the community, for, you know, black youth, you know, to see someone go through that path and be a role model was very important for the growth of the league and for the country that we live in. I think his legacy will be understated forever, given what he did and when he did it. And that's what makes this just such, as every passing is so sad, but the impact he had on people, the impact he had on the league, the impact he had on the Celtics, is absolutely enormous. And that's what makes this so devastating for so many people.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we talk about you can't write the history of the NBA without Bill Russell, which is an obvious statement. You can't write U.S. history without Bill Russell because of the impact that he had in dominating. He was the league's first black superstar. He was the league's first black head coach. He made, inroads as a broadcaster. He, he even crossed over into commercial success. He even got some acting gigs. Like he became a little bit of everything, one of those players who transcends pop culture enough to do something like host Saturday Night Live in its heyday, and that's when, it sounds silly in a way, but that, when you get to do those things, it's because you've become this household name. And by becoming the household name, it just advanced all of the other things that he was responsible for. When they put up the statue for him in Boston, he didn't want it by the garden. He put it out. He wanted it someplace where it could be enjoyed by everyone, seen by everyone. And he didn't want it to be about just basketball. He wanted it to be about the mentorship. And so, yes, it's a statue of him holding a basketball, but around the statue is a lot of symbolism about the mentorship that he's been responsible for. That's the thing. He latched his message onto his game, and the game spoke very, very loudly, but the off-court message was just as loud, and it would be a disservice to Bill Russell to talk about him today in purely basketball terms, because that's not who he was. He was more than that. And I think that's one of my key things. We all want to talk about how dominant he was on the court. Him against Wilt Chamberlain, the slight 6'9" William Fenton Russell against the big behemoth Wilt Chamberlain, and just taking on that challenge over and over and over again and winning each time is amazing. It's not all he was, and it's just important to include all of that in the remembrances and the celebration of who he was.
Yeah, I think that you speak to his impact beyond basketball and what it means today. Like, the president is putting out a statement about his passing. That's the sort of impact he had on the country, and
right,
since his time playing the game is at that level. Adam Silver, of course, the commissioner of the league, will put out a statement, but called him the greatest champion ever. Several team owners put out a statement, some that played like MJ, some that didn't. The Pacers put out a team statement, for example. All those things just speak to the impact he had on every single franchise. And there's a reason he was considered the best to ever do it for 40 plus years. Some still consider him that to this day. If you consider the resume of winning for, being the premier argument in a greatest of all time debate, he won the time.
And I
don't, at every level, first gold medal, I think, for USA basketball as well. I may be misspeaking there, but one of the first, Olympic medalists as well. His list of accomplishments, both on and off the court, is so long. His Wikipedia page is unbelievable. And you speak to his acting exploits, of course. My favorite moment of his, flipping off Charles Barkley for absolutely no reason, is up there in Love terms it. Of the best things Love he's ever it. Done. Just completely got it with every interaction he had. And that, just an absolute legend in every way.
I loved the 2017, I think it was the NBA awards, where they brought up all of the, they brought up Shaq, Alonzo Mourning, Dikembe Mutombo, Patrick Ewing. I don't know if Hakeem Olajuwon was up there too, but they all came up to honor Bill Russell with this Lifetime Achievement Award. And he stands up there, and there's this quiet moment, and it's like this poignant. It's dominant centers from every era. Kareem was up there too. Dominant centers from every era. And he's just sitting there, and it looks like he's soaking in the moment. And then he just goes, points, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And in his gravelly voice, he goes, "I would kick your ass." And then lets out this big shriek cackle, this big signature Bill Russell laugh. But that's just perfect Bill Russell standing there frail at that point, what, 83, 84, and using a cane, and he's still like, you know what? I would kick all your asses because he was that good. He'd be like, Shaq, I can figure out Shaq. Give me 5 minutes. Let me watch a little bit of Shaq. Okay, I know what I need to do. And then he would do it. If he could stop Wilt, he can stop Shaq. He can stop anybody, as far as I'm concerned. But that attitude, that mentality, it just spoke to, yeah, that's all nice. Love you guys. But just keep in mind who number one is here. I don't have these two handfuls of rings for nothing. Don't you guys forget it. It was an amazing moment. It was awesome.
I don't think anyone will forget him for a while, and a lasting legacy everywhere, including in the league. The Finals MVP trophy will still be the Russell Trophy for as long as it's given out. It will be a shame that he cannot be there anymore. I think what was the last one he was able to do was 2019, 2018? I can't remember.
Geez, he wasn't at the bubble, right? So
yeah, the bubble, he couldn't be there, certainly. So
for the bubble, yeah. So
geez. Toronto, Kawhi Leonard probably was the last one that he was able to do. But that trophy will still be given out. It will mean so much for years to come. For more on this, John Corrales and Locked On Celtics is your way to go. I'm sure you will have all the stories and everything about Bill Russell in the coming week. Bill Russell was a legend in every way. And like John said, Locked On Celtics is the way to go for more on his passing and his impact and legacy that he will have. Let's pivot and continue talking about the current NBA and news from around the league. Before we do that, though, I would like to really quickly talk to you guys about Built Bar, who are bringing you this podcast. If you haven't tried Built Bar Puffs yet, you are depriving yourself of one of life's greatest joys. And guess what? There's a new flavor, ready, delicious, indulgent cookie dough covered in chocolate. That's right. Built Bar has done it again. Let me introduce you to your new favorite protein bar, their cookie dough chunk puff, light and chewy texture, cookie dough flavored chunks, and of course, 100% covered in chocolate. It basically tastes like a candy bar. I've tried them and absolutely love them. All the joys of eating cookie dough without the hassle of making it, and it's healthy for you. The puffs are only 160 calories, and they have a whopping 15 grams of protein in them. It's collagen protein that your body absorbs faster, so it's a healthy, delicious protein bar that tastes like a candy bar. What's not to like? They have a ton of other flavors as well that you can see right on their website, and a mixed package where you can get a bunch of their most popular flavors. Go check them out at built.com. Use the promo code LOCKED15. When you're checking out, you'll get 15% off your order. That promo code again is LOCKED15 for 15% off at built.com. Welcome back to Locked On NBA, everybody. Thanks for making us your first listen every single day. For your second listen, hop on over to Locked On Cavs to hear from who we're about to hear from, Chris Manning, talking about the latest on the Cleveland Cavaliers. Let's switch gears a little bit. Talk about the best free agent still on the market in the Cavaliers' orbit, Colin Sexton. Very strange situation, very reflective of how restricted free agency goes for these kind of players who are good but not quite good enough to fetch those max deals. When the money dries up, someone's got to be left out there, and in this case, it's Sexton, still unsigned. And the reporting from Cleveland.com's Chris Fedor, among others, suggests that the outstanding offer to Colin Sexton from the Cavs is 3 years and $40 million as restricted free agent. He would like more than that. The only teams with space to give him more than that are Indiana, San Antonio, and Detroit. Chris, where is this heading? Is that even a fair offer for a guy who scored 24 points per game two seasons ago? That's a very loaded question. Talk me through this situation.
I think it's a little bit low. I think he's better than that number. Now, do I think he's significantly better than that? I don't know. I think you're still betting on him being someone that's going to get better. If you look at the guys that are still left out in the free agency market, like the other names, it's like Montrezl Harrell, Dennis Schroeder, Blake Griffin, Carmelo, Dwight Howard, who like might be going to WWE and not playing in the NBA. Like these are like this. These are the guys that are left, and then Colin Sexton is just kind of there, right? So I think that number is a little bit low, but it seems to me, Tony, that the Cavs are both in a position where they feel like they can squeeze him and try to lower his value for their making cap purposes. But if you look at also just what it seems like they maybe think of Colin Sexton, the fact that they're not going out of their way to like maybe offer him more, to move one of the guys who need to bring him back and pay him, you know, maybe $15 million a year or something, and trying to be more aggressive and getting a deal done, to me at least says something about what they seem to think about him at this point in time, coming off a year where he was injured and the team frankly was not to his fault, but just the real ascendance of the Cleveland Cavaliers happened after he got hurt.
Yeah, on one hand, the injury makes me understand why that it is this way for him right now. But on the other hand, you've seen guys like Marvin Bagley agree to terms with his incumbent team. Same with Mo Bamba. You know, a couple other guys from that draft class have already found their deals out there. Lonnie Walker, DiVincenzo, Troy Brown. So, yes, they had different cases. But a lot of these guys, even ones that aren't max guys, are switching teams, were able to find something. Sexton has ended up being the last guy, which is a lot of times very unfortunate in this restricted free agency game. And another factor to me, which you can speak more to, is the Cavs specifically, they have Darius Garland, they have Caris LeVert, they have Ricky Rubio, they have other guys who might be in the mix at guard spots. Okoro played the two sometimes for that team last year. You know, that could be, to me at least, another reason why it might be hard for them to want to commit a lot to them. They have a lot of resources invested into those spots already.
Yeah, I mean, I think the plan will be for Ricky Rubio to do a lot of the stuff Ricky Rubio did before his ACL injury when he comes back from that injury. I think that's not going to be until 2023, but, you know, there's time to come there, obviously. But Caris LeVert, as you noted, you know him from covering him with the Pacers. He plays with the ball in his hands. Like, he's not a guy that's going to totally thrive off ball. You're hoping, I think, that Darius Garland can continue what he did last year when it was really his offense. You're not really going to try to take away from that, I think, too much. And not only are there guards, but there's also Evan Mobley in here, too, who I think is poised for an offensive leap. So there's just, like, a lot that is changing here that is going to change what Colin Sexton, I think, is going to be asked to do and what kind of role he's going to be asked to fill. The apex of Colin Sexton we've probably seen so far, or at least, like, what defines him to me as a player in my head, when I think of him, is that 42-point game he had against the Nets. When the Nets put together that big three, he had 20 straight in that game. It was very much Colin playing with the ball in his hands, running pick and roll, taking pull-up mid-range shots, some pull-up threes as well. But the ball was in his hands. He was dictating the flow of the offense. That is not going to be his role anymore. It can't exist. When there may be spurts of that, there may be a game or two here and there where he gets to do that. But if he's going to be back on the Cavs next year, that version of Colin Sexton, I don't think, can really exist anymore. And I think if you're the Cavs, you're probably saying, okay, like, if we're going to have to move your role and figure that out and still bet on you, like, there, I think that's where they say the valuation, which is lower than, like, the $20 million a year he reportedly wanted, or even, like, getting up to, like, the 18 or so that's out there. It just doesn't seem like the value for what they think his role is going to be is quite there.
Yeah, I remember seeing those numbers floated for his value, which is fascinating to me. Like, after the 24 points per game season, and pretty efficient, by the way, above average by a small amount doing it. Obviously, his defense is the reason he's not an instant max player at that evaluation. But he was a very talented player that year. But there's just no one out there to give him the money, which is why it's so interesting to me. You know, the Spurs, they have young guards on their team already. They just drafted a few more. Even though they traded away DeJounte Murray, they have guys ready to fill those spots that they would like to give minutes to and run the show. And so Sexton doesn't make a ton of sense for them, especially at the value of money he wants. The Pacers have, you know, it's easy for me to look at them with Halliburton and Benedict Mathurin and Chris Duarte on that team. The Pistons just drafted Jaden Ivey. They have Cade Cunningham. You know, they have Killian Hayes. I don't think there's a team that's going to give him a ton more than what the Cavs are offering. Like, that's how Ayton got out of his restricted free agency dance. So it seems like this is headed to either somehow right before training camp, the Cavs and Sexton figure something out, or Sexton just says, you know what, I'm going to take my, as we talked about before, $7.2 million qualifying offer, play for a year with the Cavs, try to find my way, and figure it out as an unrestricted free agent next year when he's only 23, 24 years old.
The qualifying offer is such an interesting thing here, Tony, because we, number one, don't see a lot of guys do that, right? Like, Ayton maybe theoretically could have done that, but he was able to wait out the market enough and then get that offer from the Pacers. You know better than me, it does not seem like the Pacers are going to come and do that here and give Colin the leverage that he needs. He needs one team to give him the leverage that could change that whole thing. It just doesn't seem to be there for him right now from anywhere. The qualifying offer would be such a bold thing for him to do. It's a very much a bet on yourself thing. He would take a pay cut over what he would get on that three-year, $40 million deal, but it also gives him room to hit free agency next summer in a way that where he can just go sign with anyone. There's no strings on him. There's nothing holding him from going to sign anywhere in a summer where, like, there might be a lot of cap space for teams, it seems like. There is, to me, though, just such a risk in that for him, just because his role, as we've talked about, is shifting. And if Colin can't go put up numbers and score a lot, which is what he does well, which is going to be his defining trait, I think, in the league, with some passing, I think with some better passing than I think maybe he gets credit for. Not elite passing, but competent secondary creation. I don't know, like, if it's like an optimal position for him to go juice his value. It's like you would have to be really sure that you could do it, and it also puts a ticking clock in theory on his time with the Cavs, because at that point, like, why would they not just maybe look at him as like a $7 million expiring to play around with? Like, he loses some there's a control he gains, but there's such risk in that. And there's a reason that most guys never do this unless they absolutely have to. If you're just a rookie who doesn't work out for whatever reason, and Colin has worked out, he's been a really good player for the most part and a productive eighth overall pick. There's a reason guys don't do that, but it feels very much on the table right now as we're talking about it.
The other trouble with the qualifying offer part is, what motivation do the Cavs then have to put him in optimal positions to play well, right? He's an unrestricted free agent on an expiring deal. Do they want him to look awesome and become too expensive in 1 year, especially when he, you know, wasn't psyched about rejoining them the summer before? You know, that's always a yin and yang thing with teams, even though it's a crummy way of thinking about it. It's how the business works. They have to look out for themselves long term, so they might not even necessarily care about having Sexton in the best possible situations all the time for a season. That's why I think it would, in theory, be in both parties' best interest to figure something out for 2 or 3 years, but that's just not always reasonable when, you know, the salary cap exists, spending money exists, and players would like to be free agents as often as possible. So I'm not sure where this one's headed, and I'm curious where you, if you had to, you know, put your money on it and guess where you think this will ultimately end up going.
Wilson, one thing I should note very quickly is that if he does take the qualifying, I believe he then gets trade veto rights. So like they could say, hey, we're going to trade you to team, you know, let's say it's the Heat or whatever. And he says, I don't want to go to Miami or like Sacramento or like wherever. Like he could just say, I don't want to go there. And that there's probably some benefit to that, but that could complicate this as well. I tend to think he's still probably going to be back on the Cavs next year. I think maybe there's something here behind the scenes where we're seeing the Cavs maybe try to wait out some of these bigger deals and see if they could get involved. But the Cavs would also have to move on one of Jede Osman or Dylan Windler, I think, in all likelihood, to create a roster spot for Sexton as well. They do have a full roster right now. So there's that part of this as well that complicates this. So maybe there's just some waiting there, but I think it's more likely not that he's back. I just don't have a gauge right now on how far this drags out. This, when it gets to August and the rest of the league feels very settled and it does not feel like the Donovan Mitchell trades or the Kevin Durant trades or whatever are really moving forward, I don't know where things shake. And I don't know if there's either side is going to blink right now. It feels like they're both staring at each other, waiting for someone else to do something. And it just feels like we might be waiting until September for this. I could be very wrong. But it feels like we're just going to keep waiting and waiting and waiting. And I'd be remiss if I didn't note, the Cavs have done this with Collin is represented by Clutch. They've done this with Clutch before. Tristan Thompson, the year the Cavs ended up winning the title, this is different circumstances. Wade didn't sign his deal until, I believe, October. They did this with J.R. Smith as well. They had, obviously, having LeBron James represented by Clutch on your franchise is very much a constant negotiation of some sorts. I think these are sides that know each other. And while they've done business together before, Darius Garland got his deal done the summer, all of that, this feels like another Clutch Cavs stare down that I think both sides have been in the past shown willing to wait and wait for some leverage to provide itself for either one of them to get what they want.
The classic restricted free agency dance that never ends. They'll have more of it over on Locked On Cavs, Chris, and co-host Evan Damrell. Chris, thanks for the time. Everybody, let's talk about some Donovan Mitchell, who apparently maybe not fait accompli, that he's headed to the Knicks. Perhaps the Wizards and Hornets could get involved. Let's talk with Doug Branson from Locked On Hornets about all that. Back here on Locked On NBA, hey, thanks for making us your first listen every single day. And for your second listen, check out Locked On Hornets for more on this topic, because it came out over this weekend via various outlets. I believe first was The Athletic, that Donovan Mitchell to the Knicks, not fait accompli. Some other teams are in the mix here. The Wizards have been named, and the Charlotte Hornets have been named. A fun young Hornets team, two play-in losses in a row, potentially in the mix for Donovan Mitchell. Doug Branson from Locked On Hornets is here. Doug, talk me through this. Does this make sense as a pursuit for the Charlotte Hornets basketball team?
Well, I think it makes sense from the perspective of a team in the Charlotte Hornets that need talent, and Donovan Mitchell is one of the best talents in the NBA. It would rectify one of the bigger draft flubs in Hornets history. Around the time that Donovan Mitchell was drafted, there were loud whispers that then head coach but now head coach Steve Clifford wanted Donovan Mitchell, but Rich Cho, the GM at the time, and Jordan decided on Malik Monk when he fell, and we all know how that turned out. Malik Monk no longer with the Charlotte Hornets. Now Clifford is back. This gives the Hornets an opportunity to not only acquire, again, one of the better scorers, finishers in the NBA, but also rectify that draft flub.
Let's talk about the timing of this for Charlotte. Like, you know, two straight years, like I said, losing in the first round of the play-in tournament. LaMelo Ball is on his ascent. PJ Washington is becoming a very strong starter in this league. Does this timing make a lot of sense for Charlotte in that as these players are getting better, they need that next piece to take the next step?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the two play-in blowouts cost James Borrego his job, and now the Hornets sit with a head coach who they've signed to a contract, by the way, this head coach, Steve Clifford, a contract that has the first 2 years with an opt-out for the team. So obviously, they are in win-now mode. That makes a lot of sense because you hit the lottery, you get LaMelo Ball, who has already acquired an all-star bid. It looks like he's on the way up into all-NBA territory in the next couple of seasons, but the clock is ticking. You have to, you know, in this era of player empowerment, You as a team really have to convince these players that you can surround them with championship level talent if they have championship aspirations, which I certainly think LaMelo Ball does. And obviously the Hornets are in a weird situation this offseason with Miles Bridges, their leading scorer last season, facing three felony domestic violence charges. His future with the organization uncertain. They need to explore all options, I think, to acquire talent. If this organization is serious about not only making the playoffs but competing there in the next couple of seasons.
You nailed it from my outsider's perspective. When you have a talent like LaBall, once they make the All-Star game or even sniff it and get close enough that you know they're serious, they're really good, they can guide you to the postseason for years and years. You need to start getting that second guy in the door. I'm actually surprised you don't hear more about Dallas trying to do that because it's got to become time at some point. Porzingis wasn't the guy for them, and you know who knows what their future looks like now that they have lost Jalen Brunson. You never know how these things can turn so quickly. And when you have a chance to potentially get a guy like Donovan Mitchell, it's something you have to pursue. We can get into team fit in a moment, but to you, Doug, what kind of package would it take? You know, Utah just got the moon and the sun from the Timberwolves for Rudy Gobert, and the reporting suggests that they want more for Donovan Mitchell. I don't know if his value is more or less than that, but it seems like for a younger player with a lot of time left on his contract, there would be a lot of capital required to get a guy like Mitchell to any market.
Yeah, I mean, what's it going to require? Everything that the collective bargaining agreement allows the Charlotte Hornets to move in terms of future assets, and then whatever makes sense for Utah to take back in terms of contracts. When you look at what the Hornets have on the books, an obvious match for the salary would be Gordon Hayward, who's owed $30 million this season and $31 million next season. Obviously, it might be a little weird, Gordon Hayward going back to Utah, but they would only have to deal with that for two more seasons. Terry Rozier obviously has a long-term deal with the Charlotte Hornets. You have to pair him with maybe a PJ Washington, give up maybe some younger assets like a James Bouknight or a Kai Jones. That would make sense from a team-building perspective on the Hornets' side because Donovan Mitchell is going to do a lot of what Terry Rozier did for the team last season. But I think it's all about how many draft picks the Hornets can and would be willing to give up and essentially mortgage the near-term future to bring in Donovan Mitchell, who, by the way, is 25 years old and on a long-term contract. This would be a completely different situation from my perspective if Donovan Mitchell was on the last year of his deal or maybe even the last couple of years on his deal. But you've got Donovan Mitchell for the next three or four seasons. So whatever future I think the team ends up mortgaging, you're buying into a future with Donovan Mitchell. That just makes sense to me.
That makes sense to me as well. And I think the Hornets are kind of an interesting spot here. Like, you talk about the Knicks a lot in Donovan Mitchell rumors, mm-hmm. or most people have, and what makes them appealing is their multiple picks and interesting young talent. The Hornets, to me, have a lot of those things already on their team between guys like, not even guys who are guaranteed to be in their rotation this year, between Bouknight, between Kai Jones, two guys you already said. They just drafted Bryce McGowan's. They also have JT Thor, PJ Washington, Mark Williams. They have young pieces along with, I believe, you could correct me if I'm wrong here, all their own picks to make something happen here in a big deal. If they wanted to do that, they, I believe, have an extra pick for Devontae Graham still. It seems like the Hornets have the assets to make some sort of waves in this if they are truly interested in beating the Knicks offer? Do you feel like they can make the best offer of the teams that have been reported?
Yeah, I'm not certain they can make the best offer because I think there are teams maybe with some better player assets that could go back. I mean, you know, Gordon Hayward comes with injury issues. It's why I think the relationship between himself and the organization has soured a little bit. They've been rumored to be trying to move him and Terry Rozier this offseason. So I think there are other teams that maybe could match in terms of the player assets. In terms of the pick, the Devontae Graham extra pick was this past draft, which they then moved in that Jalen Duren deal and then acquired an extra, or not an extra, but they actually acquired a first-round pick for next season. So I don't know in terms of the pick situation exactly what they could offer back, but they're going to have to give it everything they have, plus, you know, pick swaps and that kind of thing. But I think, you know, when you're looking at the Hornets organization, they've drafted well, I think, the past couple of seasons under the Mitch Kupchak regime, but traditionally haven't been known, you know, as a team that has drafted particularly well. So I think you have to take that into consideration too, that, yeah, maybe you don't want to mortgage your entire, you know, near-term future, but Donovan Mitchell is a surefire, sure bet, all-star, all-NBA type of player that any picks you make in the next couple of seasons are going to be gambles, crapshoots. So I think you go for certainty, especially when you've already hit the lottery with LaMelo Ball and the clock is ticking on how long you'll be able to keep him.
You talked about Terry Rozier and the little bit of skill overlap that may exist between him and Mitchell, obvious as the off-ball guard who would be paired with LaMelo, and even though Mitchell would have the ball more than a guy like Terry, how do you see Mitchell fitting on the infrastructure that would still be in Charlotte after a deal like this? And to that end, do you feel like it's a good enough team to reach the postseason even without needing the play-in tournament?
So in terms of the fit, yeah, if Terry Rozier doesn't go back in the deal, then all of a sudden you've got to convince Terry Rozier, who has played a major role in this team, to move to the bench. I don't know how satisfied he would be with that, but he has been one of the team leaders for the Charlotte Hornets. So, and he's been somebody that I think last season was frustrated by the fact that the Hornets were not achieving the goals they had all set out at the beginning of the season. So maybe there could be some convincing there. Hey, we've brought enough talent in here to do what you would like to do if you take on a sixth man type of role. But in terms of the fit between Mitchell and LaMelo Ball, I think Mitchell complements LaMelo Ball perfectly and does a lot of the things that the Hornets need that they didn't have last season. He scores at the rim efficiently. Mitchell made 65% of his shots at the rim last season, according to Clean the Glass, and 80% of those makes were unassisted. The Hornets were awful at scoring at the rim, and it's honestly a gap in LaMelo Ball's game. LaMelo Ball was an amazing three-point shooter. He could do it off the bounce. He could do it on the catch and shoot, but in terms of finishing at the rim, he still has to elevate his game there. This would be a shortcut bringing in Donovan Mitchell, who can do that, draw the defense, get LaMelo Ball even better looks from three, deeper looks, or maybe even some looks closer at the rim for LaMelo Ball. I think this is like a perfect fit in terms of what the Hornets need to take their offense was already good. They were eighth in the league last season offensive rating. I think they could do what Utah did last season and become the number one offensive team. And then, wow, you know, the Hornets weren't great defensively. You could then take a little pressure off of Steve Clifford to vastly improve that defense, maybe improve a little bit. But if you're the number one offensive team, I think that's good enough to get you not just through the play-in, but possibly even into the playoffs.
I agree with all that. I think with Mitchell, they would vault quite a few teams in this Eastern Conference hierarchy. Who knows what's up with the Nets? I think they'd pass Cleveland. They'd be right in the mix for that 6-5 spot. And you'll have this and more with Walker Mell over at Locked On Hornets. Doug, thanks for the time. And everybody, thanks for checking out Locked On NBA. We're here every single day, free and available on all platforms, including YouTube. If you want to see our lovely faces talk about these topics every single day, please like and subscribe on YouTube. Have a great day, and we see you guys tomorrow.